Okay, so title of my talk today is Jets in a Strongly Coupled N equals 4 Super Young Mills Plasma. I'm going to be talking about work that I have done with my advisor Larry, as well as some work that is in progress with Christian Jensen and Andreas Karsch at the University of Washington. So, outline of my talk, I'll first tell you about why this is an interesting question to ask. I'll talk about the gravitational description of the problem in terms of ADS-CFT, string solutions, as well as boundary densities. I'll talk about hydrodynamics a bit, and then at the end I will give you some work in progress regarding baryon density, and of course conclusions. So, brief slide on motivation. So at RIC, they are colliding gold nuclei, and in the early stages of a collision, you can, produce a pair of energetic partons via some hard scattering process. After some time has passed, the resulting fireball will have thermalized, and just for the sake of example, I've assumed that the partons have been produced at the edge, the particles have been produced at the edge of the fireball. After some later time, one of them can exit the fireball, and the partner will have to travel across. It'll lose energy to the medium. It'll be sensitive to various properties of the medium, such as the speed of sound and whatnot. And of course, at the end of the day, you get hadronization, and what you get in your detector is a bunch of particles, a bunch of hadrons. And what I've shown here is two particle correlation functions taken from STAR. Okay, so the idea here is that by studying these jets, you can obtain information about the quark gluon plasma, such as the viscosity, the speed of sound, you know, various other interesting quantities. Okay, so jets in a plasma. So imagine you have some quark moving through a plasma. It will deposit energy and momentum in the plasma. It'll be some frictional drag force. And the description of the physics of the transport of energy and momentum will depend upon what scales you are asking the question. So if you are in the very near zone, here in the red, the quark is a blue quark, you will most certainly have to use a quantum field theory, a full quantum field theory treatment of the problem. As you go out to farther distances, you can presumably use nonlinear hydrodynamics or higher order hydrodynamics, just because dissipative effects will decrease the sizes of gradients. And as you go out farther and farther, the amplitudes of the perturbations caused by this quark moving through the plasma will decrease. And at asymptotically far distances, you can use linearized hydrodynamics. And of course, the exact scales in which you can break this down depend upon the coupling. If you're at weak coupling, the range in which hydrodynamics becomes valid becomes pushed out very, very far. So the ultimate goal for us would be to be able to predict that spectrum of particles that I showed you, two-particle correlation function that I showed you in the second slide. The available tools you have to do this include things like kinetic theory, but kinetic theory is not valid at a strong coupling. You have hydrodynamics, which is a universal long wavelength effective theory. However, you don't know what its range of validity is. You know that, in some sense, the range of validity should be greater than the mean free path, which in a strongly coupled plasma is, in some sense, 1 over T. And you don't know what the sources are for hydrodynamics. You don't know what the energy loss rate is of the quark. The other option that I want to discuss, and the one that I'm going to take in this talk, is to use gauge string duality. The bonus to that, the plus side of that, is it gives you a complete description of the phenomena on all length scales. So you can get hydrodynamics in the far zone and the full quantum mechanical treatment in the near zone. What I've labeled here as a plus and a minus is that it's only useful at large NC and large TIF coupling lambda. And of course, a minus is that there's no known gravitational dual for QCD. But we're going to go with it anyway because there are some interesting questions we can ask. So we're going to solve a toy problem, which will consist of considering an equilibrium super Yang-Mills plasma that's of infinite extent. We'll add fundamental quarks to it. We'll compute energy loss rates, as well as expectation values of the stress tensor and of the baryon density current, the baryon current associated with the quark. And some questions that we're going to consider are, what is the angular distribution of baryon density for a jet in super Yang-Mills, in a super Yang-Mills plasma? Where does the energy and momentum lost by the quark go? And what are the sources for hydrodynamics? And what distances from the quark does hydrodynamics apply? So just a quick slide on gauge string duality. We've probably seen a lot of these in the last few weeks. So the particular theory we're going to study is N=4 super Yang-Mills, according to Maldacena. That's dual to type 2B string theory on ADS5 cos S5. The S5 will not matter for the purpose of today's talk. Looking at super Yang-Mills at finite temperature is dual to studying the string theory in the background of a geometry that has a black brain. Adding quarks will correspond to adding open strings, etc. But of course, the punchline is that the weakly coupled string theory is dual to the strongly coupled field theory. So it allows you to address interesting questions in the field theory. Okay. So the geometry that we're going to study will consist of, it's a five-dimensional geometry. It'll have a black hole or a black brain. The line element is this right here. The radial coordinate I've denoted as u runs from a value of uh to 0. And uh is the coordinate that corresponds to the location of the event horizon of the black hole. And u = 0 corresponds to the boundary. The black hole has a temperature, according to Hawking. And that temperature is equivalent to the temperature in the field theory, and it's just given by this simple formula in terms of the horizon radius. Now, one thing that's going to be kind of, well, qualitatively important for the purpose of this talk is that the radial coordinate in the fifth dimension coordinate acts as a scale in the dual quantum field theory. So physics that takes place close to the boundary, you should think of as high energy physics in the field theory, and physics that takes place close to the horizon, you should think of as low energy physics. So if I put, for example, some source into the bulk, and I wiggle it around, and it produces some kind of radiation, whether it be gravitational or electromagnetic, if I'm really close to the boundary, say up here, this thing's not working that well, is it? If I'm close to the boundary, say right here, that radiation won't have it won't be able to spread out much. And what you'll see on the boundary is something that's very, very localized. If you're farther down, it'll be able to spread out, etc. Now, when you add a black hole in, you get an extra effect. You get gravitational redshift. So if you emit any radiation from near the event horizon, that'll become very, very long wavelength by the time it reaches the boundary. And you should think about that type of radiation as giving rise to hydrodynamic modes. And I'll discuss that more. So adding open strings to the geometry corresponds to adding QQ bar pairs. A D7 brain comes along, and the endpoints of the string can go no further than the coordinate of the D7 brain, which I've called UM. In the field theory, this corresponds to adding a massive N=2 hypermultiplet to the theory. And you can go on ahead and compute what the bare mass of the quarks is, and it scales like 1 over the TIF coupling divided by, the TIF coupling divided by UM. So in the limit where you take this D brain up to the boundary, you're studying infinitely massive quarks. Just to give you a qualitative idea on why this actually makes sense, that is, adding strings corresponds to adding quarks to the boundary theory, the endpoints of the strings are charged under a U1 gauge field in the bulk. And that gauge field will extend up to the boundary, And just as in electromagnetism, when you have some sort of dielectric medium or a conductor, in the presence of an electric field, you will induce some sort of density on that object. So here, that conductor is the boundary of ADS space. And what I've shown here, just in a cartoon fashion, is that the string endpoint will induce a baryon current on the boundary that will be, in some sense, correlated with the position of the string endpoint. The string will also be charged gravitationally. That will perturb the geometry. And as I'll discuss in a few moments, that perturbation in the geometry will give rise to a change in the stress tensor on the boundary. So we're going to study two limiting cases here because they're the easiest in some sense. One case will correspond to infinitely massive quarks. In that limit, the string will actually end on the boundary. And the rest of the string will trail down and go to the black hole. The other case that we'll study will be zero bare mass. And in that limit, the D-brain fills all of the ADS geometry, the ADS black hole geometry, and strings are actually allowed to fall. Okay, gravity pulls things down, and so the strings are going to want to fall down. And so here's, you know, a typical event that we're going to study, a string at three different times. Okay?
What if the infinite mass quark not
Well, the string endpoint can go no further away from the boundary than the D-brain, than the lower coordinate that the D-brain extends. It's fixed.
But any finite mass would
also fall. If you give it a finite mass, that corresponds to, say, giving the D-brain some finite radial coordinate, and you're going to fix the endpoint of the string. Well, the string can fall, I guess. Let me draw this picture a little bit.
Boundary condition, you fix it.
So your string will never get, at least in the large mass limit, will never get below this lower coordinate of the D7 brain. Okay.
Regardless of mass, any non-zero mass.
Yeah, any non-zero mass. But when you take the mass to be strictly zero, this lower coordinate extends down below the horizon, and so they fall.
And the string endpoint doesn't have a start at the lower edge of that D-brain.
No, yeah, absolutely. You can start right here and then fall down to right there. Okay? You can think about this, I'll talk about this in a minute. Okay, so the case of heavy quarks.
What is special about the global head?
Can you ask that again?
We just said that it can be anywhere between U equals 0 and U m. Mm-hmm. Right? And then if it's down at U m, what physical situation does it correspond to?
Well, I guess you would say that it's as spread out as it can be for a given energy, right? The baryon density on the boundary will be as spread out as it can possibly be when it is at the lower end.
Zero momentum, or it's everywhere the same way.
So, some time ago, maybe a year and a half, 2 years ago, the energy loss rate for massive quarks was computed by several different groups. There is a string profile which moves at constant velocity v, and that's what I've shown right here. I haven't shown it at infinite mass, but very, very large mass. And so here's the string profile. You can look at the energy density of the string as a function of the spatial coordinate x here, and this is what you get right here. You see that you have a very, very high energy near the string endpoint, and in the trailing edge of the string, you get a constant energy density. That constant energy density corresponds to the constant energy loss rate per unit length traveled by the quark. And of course, I told you earlier that the radial coordinate, you should think about that as being an energy scale. The endpoint of the string is up really high. Therefore, it has a lot of gravitational potential energy, and that's why you see a lot of energy right here. And so a natural question to consider is, how does this, let me back up just a second, sorry. You see, you have an energy flux that flows down from the string endpoint into the trailing string, okay? A natural question to consider is, how does that transfer of energy from one reservoir, that would be in the, that would be the quark, to another reservoir, being the trailing string, how does that get mapped onto the boundary theory? And what does the wake look like? The wake of the
quark? What is the party line relative to this other idea of energy loss?
Say again?
There's this other method of computing energy losses by expectation values of light, like Wilson Moore's, followed by Wiedemann, Rajakova, and others. Mm-hmm. What is the party line relative to that idea?
Oh, I don't know off the top of my head.
You don't? I'll be more more direct. There are good ways of doing things, and there are bad ways of doing things.
So that, which one is the good one?
It's the one with this.
Yeah, right. Although this is about light quarks.
It's about light.
No, this is heavy quarks,
but
right?
Paul's going to talk about one way of discussing light quarks later.
But since they say, I mean, they defend their idea by stating that it's, they are looking at fast-moving quarks in a,
they do indeed defend their ideas.
You are saying
circular logic is a wonderful reasoning tool.
Okay, so we want to understand how this flow of energy from the string endpoint down to the trailing part of the string gets mapped into the dual field theory. And the way it works out is not too complicated, at least qualitatively. So the presence of the string will disturb the geometry, which is in turn governed by Einstein's field equations. In the large end limit in which your gravitational description of this phenomenon is actually valid, the gravitational constant, which I've called kappa 5 squared, will become arbitrarily small. It scales like 1 over nc squared. And so in that limit, you should really just linearize the Einstein field equations. Physically, what this corresponds to is the fact that you have added a fundamental quark to a plasma of adjoint fields. So your geometry, your ADS metric, will induce symmetric on the boundary. And the expectation value of the stress tensor is just given by the variational derivative of the gravitational action with respect to this boundary metric.
What do you ascribe
that to Wick? There are some other names you can put there too.
Einstein.
For this one right here? Einstein wasn't around. And so, you know, you can, if you choose certain gauges, such as one that has been discussed in the last two talks. If you choose a certain coordinate system that's called Pfefferman-Gram coordinates, you can go on ahead and show that this variational derivative basically leads to the expression that we saw yesterday for T mu equals some constant times G mu nu, the fourth term in the expansion near the boundary. Or you can take another approach, which I will briefly discuss here. The Super-Yang-Mills stress tensor is traceless, and it's conserved. And if you work out the math, you see that it only contains 5 independent degrees of freedom. The metric perturbations is a 5x5 symmetric matrix that contains 15 degrees of freedom. So there's more degrees of freedom in the metric perturbation than there are in the Super-Yang-Mills stress tensor. But of course, GR is a gauge theory. And so these extra degrees of freedom are, you should think about them as just being gauge-dependent degrees of freedom. And so this suggests that you should formulate the bulk-to-boundary problem in terms of gauge invariant degrees of freedom. Basically, if you solve the Einstein field equations for all components of h mu nu in some given gauge, you're doing extra work. You're calculating information that is gauge dependent, and you don't need to do it. If you take convenient, if you look at certain gauge invariant quantities, you can label them by a helicity, a spin, if you will. If you go to Fourier space, you can take linear combinations of h mu nu that transform with definite helicity under rotations about the q hat axis. And what you find is that these gauge invariants obey decoupled equations of motion. So you're only solving for as much information as you actually need. Okay? And you can work out the variation of the gravitational action, which is this, in this case here, it's for the infinitely massive quark. And you get a nice simple expression in terms of the gauge invariance. You get a term that looks like it's not gauge invariant because its divergence gives you the drag force on the quark. And you get a term that just gives you the background equilibrium stress tensor. Of course, something is supplying energy to the quark in order to keep it moving at constant velocity, and that's a background electric field that lives on the boundary. So this variation will cancel off the violation of gauge invariance from right here. Okay? So what do you get? Here are some pictures of the energy density and energy flux for V equals 1/4. One quarter. Infinitely heavy quarks.
Is that problem simpler than finite mass quarks?
It is simpler because you don't have to. Well, first of all, for finite mass quarks, you can have if you don't have the endpoint of your string ending on the D-brain, you can have time-dependent string profiles in the bulk. You don't have steady-state solutions necessarily. So that's a big simplification there,
too. You could look at something that's moving at a constant speed.
You could. The one thing about that, though, is that you get a contribution to the energy density in the near zone that will be temperature independent, and it's basically going to be a smeared out Coulomb field. In taking the infinite mass limit, we have you can calculate that part analytically and just subtract it off. So in these plots, I've subtracted off the energy density that corresponds to the Coulomb field, and I've subtracted off the energy density that corresponds to the delta function energy of an infinitely massive quark. Okay? So on the left here is the energy density multiplied by the radius from the quark. On the right here is the energy flux. The magnitude of the plot is the magnitude of the energy flux. Magnitude of the surface is the magnitude of the energy flux. And the flow lines superimposed on top are the flow lines of the actual Poynting vector. So.
Sorry, how did you make this plot on the right, just for curiosity? How did you make this?
With MATLAB. Okay, so what you see is nothing too exciting right here. And over here, you see a diffusion wake, which I'll describe in more detail. If you crank the speed up, things look dramatically different. So this is moving at 3/4 the speed of light. Super-Yang-Mills is a conformal theory, so the speed of sound is c squared equals 1/3. So this is supersonic motion. And what you see in the energy density and the energy flux is the clear formation of a Mach cone. If you plug in the numbers, you see that this should occur about 50 degrees, and sure enough, it does. You also see this diffusion wake here that you saw in the subsonic case. When you look at these plots, at least when I looked at these plots, I'm reminded basically of what does the wake behind a boat look like, for example, right? You get a pressure mode right here, and a corresponding energy flux associated with that. But also, you drag water with you. The boat will drag water behind it. And that's what you're seeing right here. And so you should ask yourself, how well does a hydrodynamic description of this phenomena really work? So let me talk about hydrodynamics for a couple minutes. So write the stress tensor as the equilibrium part plus a perturbation. As I told you in the gravitational theory, in the large n limit, the background stress tensor is order n squared, nc squared, and the perturbation due to the, in the stress tensor due to the fundamental quark is order n c to the zero. And what that implies is that the hydrodynamic equations of motion will be linear everywhere that hydrodynamics applies. You will not have a nonlinear description of the wake. You might have to go out to higher order in derivatives if you want to go in really close, but everything will be linear. And of course, that occurred in the gravitational calculation too. So here's the typical typical linear expansion for hydrodynamics. I've included a second order term there just for illustration purposes. We will not consider that in what follows. We're just going to use linearized viscous hydrodynamics. And so your equations of motion for hydrodynamics just follow from the energy momentum conservation equation right here, where F is the drag force density on the quark, which in the case where you have an infinitely massive quark, it'll have delta function support. However, you can't apply your hydrodynamic decomposition of the stress tensor in the near zone where this is non-vanishing. You have very large gradients in the stress in the near zone, as you saw in the plots that I just showed you. And also non-hydrodynamic degrees of freedom can be important. So what do? You say, I'm going to take all the slop into account with some effective source J. It's whatever it has to be to get the right answer in the far zone.
So your Timu at the top is the true microscopic.
Yes, exactly.
Timu, and Timu at the bottom is
the hydrodynamic. Exactly. This is the exact microscopic energy momentum conservation equation, whereas this is an effective one just for the hydrodynamic degrees of freedom valid in the far zone. And so you can go on ahead and reason some simple properties of your effective source. The first, that's what I'm going to discuss. So there are some very simple properties of the effective source, which I'll now discuss. First of all, it has to be local. It can't be spread out. You have to be able to do a gradient expansion. It has to be possible to do a gradient expansion of this effective source. And the first form has to just be a delta function. The second thing is that it has to be consistent with the exact microscopic energy momentum conservation equation. So if you imagine dragging your quark through a plasma at velocity v for some long period of time, you can compute what the total energy transferred to the plasma is with just the microscopic energy momentum conservation equation. It's got to be just delta t times the drag force f. You should be able to compute this with hydrodynamics too. If you wait a long period of time, all of the energy and momentum that you've transferred to the plasma will have relaxed. It'll be long wavelength. It'll be spread out. And so you should be able to just integrate the stress tensor over all space. And a short exercise using this right here tells you that J0 is just in fact equal to the drag force on the quark. Okay, this doesn't fix higher order terms in the gradient expansion, but these will all come with additional derivatives and they'll lead to contributions that'll be suppressed by inverse powers of distance. So this is what we've done. You can go on ahead and substitute this all into the hydrodynamic equations of motion, and a straightforward exercise leads you to the following set of equations. The energy density satisfies a wave equation, a damped wave equation, and the longitudinal component of the energy flux also satisfies a damped wave equation. The transverse component of the energy flux, it satisfies a diffusion equation. So, you know, here's the typical pictures that you see in freshman physics books for pictorial representations of solutions to these equations. You have some particle going along emitting sound waves, and it's moving supersonically here. Because these equations are damped right here, the sound waves will spread out as time progresses. And what you will get is a Mach cone that's not discontinuous, but rather smooth and also one that will spread out with distance from the quark. And of course, there's this, the same corresponding picture for the diffusion wake. And these look very similar to what we just saw in the the plots that I showed you earlier from the gravitational calculation. I just want to emphasize right now that in solving the hydrodynamic equations of motion, you are using information that is not contained in the bulk to boundary problem in itself. That is, you're not taking any information from the boundary stress tensor that we computed and putting it into this calculation. You're taking information from the viscosity, which gives you this attenuation constant and the diffusion constant. That was computed a long time ago. And you're also taking the information just from knowledge of what the drag force is on the quark, which was, again, computed a couple years ago. And so a simple quantity to compare is the angular distribution of power. Basically, you take your energy flux, you surround it by a sphere, and you compute how the power radiated is a function of angle. And this involves both the sound and diffusion modes. And so here are some plots. This is for subsonic motion. The solid curves are the results of the gravitational calculation, and the symbols are the results of the hydrodynamic calculation. And the various curves are at different distances from the quark. So this is at 5 over pi t, 10 over pi t, and 20 over pi t. And of course, what you see, very obviously, is that these curves are almost identical. Hydrodynamics for subsonic motion works very, very well. If you go to supersonic motion, it doesn't work quite as well, but it's still very well. So this part of the energy power corresponds to the diffusion mode. This part right here corresponds to the sound mode. And of course, you see that it vanishes in the forward direction. That's just the fact that nothing's traveling faster than the speed of sound. And you see that at large distances, the agreement is very, very good. As you go down to, say, 5 over pi t, the agreement is still good. It's not quite as good as it was before. That's just because for supersonic motion, you have a Mach cone. And that Mach cone has gradients that are fairly large on it. So it's natural to expect it, hydrodynamics not to work in the near zone as well as it did for subsonic motion. But again, it's still very good. And so what do we learn? Well, I've told you this already. One thing that I want to say is that in matching hydrodynamics up to the gravitational, the full result obtained via the gravitational calculation, the effect of viscosity was important. If you neglected the viscosity, you would get a discontinuous energy density and energy flux across the Mach cone, and you would also get a diffusion wake that has zero width. Okay, the width of the diffusion wake is governed by the diffusion constant, and if you take that diffusion constant to zero, you get something that has delta function support. So you should really use viscous hydrodynamics to understand these things. So I kind of want to switch gears now and talk to you a little bit more about light quarks. I don't have as many results. It's mainly going to be a work in progress. So let me get started. So this right here is what a typical event looks like for the light quarks. We start off with some initial conditions that are point-like right here, and you time evolve. And as time moves on, the endpoints will fall on some trajectory, and the string will approach the black hole. The string actually never falls into the black hole in coordinate time. It gets asymptotically close. And so questions we want to consider is, how is the baryon density on the boundary correlated with the endpoint motion of the string? And for a given energy, how far do the endpoints actually travel? What is the light quark energy loss rate?
Where are the light quarks now? If you have this hanging loop, you know, they're at the endpoints. And
where are the light quarks?
Here.
We'll get to that. We'll get to that in a moment. They basically correspond with the position of the endpoint of the string, but I will answer that in a much more careful fashion in just a moment. I think on the next slide, actually. two more slides, sorry. So what we want to do is compute the baryon density on the boundary to answer that question. Where is the baryon density localized on the boundary? And this is a generalization of the gravitational problem that we just solved, although it's actually a lot easier. Again, the string endpoints are charged under a U1 gauge field. You have their equations of motion are just governed by curve space Maxwell's equations. The boundary conditions on the gauge field are such that the boundary behaves as a conductor. And so to calculate what the induced baryon density on the boundary is, you are basically doing a problem, a curve space problem, that we've all already done. Namely, you have a conductor, you put a charge beneath it, calculate the charge induced on it. You use the method of images. This example, we won't be able to do that because it's in curved space, but nevertheless, it's that simple. You put a little Gaussian pillbox here. You can compute that the induced baryon density on the boundary, the induced current on the boundary, is just given by the normal component of the electric field up to a factor of root g. So it's a pretty straightforward problem. And so this is what you get here. So this plot right here shows the baryon density integrated over transverse directions. Okay.
I have a question. This light versus heavy force, where does the universality of falling get broken?
Well, it's because the heavy quarks cannot fall beyond a certain radial coordinate, because they're limited by the presence of this D-brain. So when you have zero bare mass, that D-brain fills all of space, and the endpoint motion of the strings is unrestricted. OK?
And what would you do if you just want to run apart?
You're not allowed to do that by gauge invariants, right? So you're
partnered.
You can do that, but you cannot locally create charge. So what you are doing here is you can think about this qualitatively, at least, as operating on this thermal state with some current operator that creates locally some Q-Q-bar pair.
You can have a single quark that falls through the horizon. You're in deconfined things. You can perfectly have.
But you cannot create a single quark by itself. You always have to create a QQ bar pair.
Is the pair at rest?
No, it's not at rest. I mean, you can. There are initial conditions that you can consider.
You mean the center of mass of the pair?
It depends upon what your initial conditions are. For this particular plot, we've chosen initial conditions such that the total spatial momentum vanishes. Okay. So the total momentum is zero.
And the whole space.
Sure, just different initial conditions. No, you can't. And that actually shows up in the gravitational theory in a very nice fashion. Nothing can move faster than the speed of light in the gravitational theory. And so because gravity is always pulling you down a little bit, you always have some velocity in the radial direction. Your velocity in the Minkowski space directions is always less than c. It's never going to be C.
So you could not model a pion quark anti-quark pair moving with light velocity and sort of connect with button model. That you cannot do.
You can model it moving slightly less than C.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. I mean, we've added a hypermultiplet to the theory that has zero bare mass, but there's no reason to think that it shouldn't pick up a thermal mass. And this nicely illustrates the fact that you can never move at the speed of light in the transverse directions. So in these plots, you see baryon density for anti-baryon, baryon. The endpoints of the string are oppositely charged. I didn't tell you that. And so what you see is that the motion of the baryon density on the boundary closely follows the string. If you actually compute the expectation value of, well, the center of charge, and plot it on top of the Minkowski space trajectory of the endpoint of the string, you'll see that they agree almost perfectly. except for when the string gets close to the event horizon, when the endpoint gets close to the event horizon. This is perhaps not too surprising. If you think about the way that light propagates in this background, if you're at some radial coordinate that's not very, very close to the event horizon, it never takes a time that's much larger than 1 over pi t for light to reach the boundary. So what that means is that as long as you're not doing any kind of crazy motion, as long as you're doing motion that's fairly regular, the baryon density on the boundary will track the motion of the string up to a slop factor that's of order 1 over pi t. In this case, the motion is so smooth that that at least for the early times before you fall into the horizon, they're dead on.
Can I ask about this figure? Do I interpret it so that you have two there initially close by, then they move off from each other? That's how I should interpret it.
I'll show you a movie in just a second. So one thing that's also very, very nice to point out is that as the string approaches the event horizon, the electric field feels a strong gravitational redshift, and correspondingly, the baryon density on the boundary will actually spread out. And that corresponds to, of course, just thermalization of the baryon density. So you see the full-time evolution here from creation event to thermalization. And of course, the fact that the string endpoint only travels a finite distance is related to the fact that you have energy loss in the boundary theory.
One more question about the initial condition. What's the initial condition for the endpoints? Do you give them an initial velocity going away from each other?
Yeah, exactly.
Could you just let them fall?
Yeah, you can. It's not particularly interesting insofar that you don't really have quasiparticles on the boundary. You want to have some sort of localized lump of baryon density, at least for a quasi-particle description. You want to have a localized lump of baryon density that you can make translate arbitrarily far. Okay? And in the dual gravitational theory, that corresponds to saying, I want to give the endpoints of the string a very, very large kick in the spatial directions. Okay? Because eventually they're going to fall into the black hole. If you don't give them a large kick, they'll fall into the black hole without traveling much spatial distance.
So in that block, what's the initial velocity that you've chosen?
Ooh, I don't remember off the top of my head. It's very close to C. I think it's C to 1 part in 10 to the 4. It's very close. The gamma factor is on the order of 100, 150. So.
Why are the quarks created at the boundary? What's the physical reason they're created there and not made here?
Well, it's a matter of choice. You could create, they're actually not created at the boundary itself. They're created close to the boundary. The amount of energy the amount of energy in the state that you're looking at is, loosely speaking, inversely proportional to the initial radial coordinate that you're starting at. So if you don't create them near the boundary, you're going to be looking at a low energy state. And if you're looking at a low energy state, they're not going to the endpoints will not propagate far. You're not going to be looking at a quasi-particle state. Okay? You want to have something that has a very high energy so that you actually can call it a quasi-particle. Okay?
That was your choice.
That was my choice, exactly. You didn't have to do it, but it's the most interesting question you can ask. So
this corresponds to the fact that the plasma is hot.
Yeah, exactly. So here's a movie of the event here. Hopefully this will actually work. I should warn you that I used a finite Fourier transform range to make this, so some of the widths that you actually see are numerical effects because I've used a finite Fourier transform range. But anyway, this is it. So this is the initial creation event right here. The black hole, the black rain is the black thing. Well, I haven't started the movie yet. okay, and so anyway, here, I'll get down so you can see it. There you go. And so as the string endpoints get close to the horizon, everything spreads out. What you're left with, although this picture doesn't really illustrate it well, the last one did, is two lumps of baryon density right here and right here. Opposite charge, of course. Okay?
So just to reiterate, the upper picture is the baryon density, and below that
Exactly. And the amplitude of these fronts here decreases very, very fast. Again, all of the baryon density is localized at a coordinate right above the endpoint of the string. And it just diffuses.
It is a fractional baryon density. You really have fundamental quarks.
It's, well, you can normalize it to 1, plus or minus 1. The baryon, just like in electromagnetism, when you put a charge beneath a conductor, the amount of charge induced on the conductor is just minus the charge that you're looking at. You have the same thing here. Okay, it's for the exact same reason. Now let me see if I restart PowerPoint. Okay. And so you can take that same plot that I just showed you, you can integrate it over a radius and produce an angular distribution of baryon density. And this is what you get. I told you just a moment ago that I have a finite Fourier transform range, so I get enlarged widths. That shows up right here insofar that in the beginning you have something with an enlarged width that's due to numerical effects, and it's really, really close to the origin, so it's very, very spread out. But as you time evolve and you go farther and farther out, what you see is an angular distribution of baryon density that's highly localized. It's localized at about a degree here. And you can compute during this intermediate time zone, you can compute the angular distribution of baryon density, and what you find is that it scales like 1 over gamma. And of course, you can also see that at late times, this becomes very diffuse. That corresponds to the times in which the string endpoints become asymptotically close to the event horizon. And you can compute what the baryon density is there, and you get that it basically satisfies a diffusion equation. It's a gradient of a diffusion kernel. Basically, you know, you have two bits of baryon density that are in essence a dipole, okay? And so this is the dipole approximation, I guess you could say. Okay. So as far as future directions, things that we want to calculate, but we don't have completely done yet, we want to get the light quark energy loss rate and the penetration distance. This requires some tuning regarding the initial conditions of the string, as well as some semi-analytics. We, of course, also want to get the light quark wake, see if hydrodynamics works well. What you also would expect to be very different is that the light quarks will lose a lot of energy in the initial stages of their trajectory. And so the amplitude of the wake far away that corresponds to the initial time should be much larger relative to the infinitely massive quark plots that I showed you earlier. And of course, another interesting thing is just to look at jets at zero temperature. Can jets in super Yang mills at zero temperature shine light on jets in QCD? So, conclusions. Well, we computed the stress tensor of an infinitely massive quark moving through a super Yang mills plasma, strongly coupled plasma. The calculation was valid on all length scales. We saw the clear formation of two hydrodynamic modes, a sound mode and a diffusion mode. Because the calculation was valid on all length scales, we could compare to hydrodynamics. The hydrodynamic calculation was independent, and we saw excellent agreement between hydrodynamics and the complete result down to distances on the order of 1.5 over pi t from the quark. And we computed the baryon density of the light quark and found a highly focused jet, and you could explicitly see the thermalization occur in that jet. And that is it.
Could you say a few more words about your feature direction comparing jets at zero temperature, presumably in N equals 4 and in QCD, given that QCD is confined at zero temperature?
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
it's, you're basically looking at some dressed excitation. You could ask the same question in QED, where it's not a confining theory, it's a weakly coupled theory. You have some dressed excitation propagating along. It's going to emit soft radiation. And you want to ask, what are the properties of that radiation? How does it spread out with distance?
N equals 4 is your temperature because of conformal invariance, presumably.
Exactly. We're not.
It's going to be very different from QCD.
There will be some different things, absolutely. I mean, confinement's a very, very big thing that's going to be different. And conformal invariance, it's a question. Can we shine light on jets in QCD?
But isn't temperature just a scale in terms of which I guess if you measure everything, so should it just drop out?
No, not really. I mean, the physics is completely different at finite temperature.
You've introduced another scale by choosing energy of initial pair.
So
yeah,
if
but then it's the ratio. So what your Hedrick warp limit should just
if you look at this plot here.
That's now a second ratio.
Oh, okay.
If you look at this plot right here, this early time behavior or right here is basically zero temperature physics.
Okay.
When you do this calculation right here, it's a zero temperature calculation. It's because you're very, very close to the boundary of the theory. You have a nice expansion parameter in the gravitational theory, which is your radial coordinate divided by the horizon radius to the fourth power. So it's a very good expansion.
There are two phenomena which produce conical structure. And one is supersonic motion, but there's also superluminal motion, which generates a current of radiation, and there is the debate what is in real life in the plasma. And my question is the following: can you really distinguish between these two in your gravitational calculations?
Well, absolutely. Let me give you just the first answer, just saying we compared it to hydrodynamics and got very good agreement. The second thing you can do is you can compute in Fourier space, you can compute the Fourier series expansion and powers of momentum. Okay? And you can resum that series and see that it exactly agrees with hydrodynamics, except for terms that will Fourier transform to local contributions to the stress tensor. That is, you get a term that basically has delta function support that corresponds to non-hydrodynamic degrees of freedom. And then all of the terms that fall off with the power law are exactly what you would predict with hydrodynamics.
Okay, but you simply refer with similarity to hydrodynamics, So since it is difficult to formulate the problem in gravitational description, which involves color degrees of freedom, you produce something, but in my opinion, it's very difficult to distinguish what generates this energy momentum tensor, whether there are color degrees of freedom or hydrodynamics.
Well, what do you mean by color degrees of freedom?
In real life, simply the physics is very different. You have charged particle which flies and generates radiation. That you have cone.
But hydrodynamics, the hydrodynamic treatment doesn't care about how the energy was deposited, what was actually responsible for the energy loss. It only cares that energy was deposited at some location at some time. Okay? Now, when you look at the gravitational data in Fourier space, for example, you can clearly see hydrodynamic poles. And they exactly coincide with what you expect from hydrodynamics. The long distance behavior of these plots is purely governed by these poles. It is hydrodynamics.
You assumed always that you have this nice thermal background and all these processes not disturb this thermal background. Then that's probably easy to understand. You consider late times and long distances, small deviations from equilibrium. Is it also clear when we do this comparison how hydrodynamics works, how well, how far in distance? that one shouldn't in real life also consider that you don't, that you disturb also your thermal background, that it's not thermal? See, you never have a non-thermal physics happening in a completely thermal background. What is the argument that one can, discussing all these physics,
I suppose you would
consider a thermal background?
I'm not really sure what the answer is to that.
But do note the picture of the wake was a picture of the disturbance to the equilibrium background. That was calculating the back reaction. But for this problem, it's a small back reaction. Because you're adding just one quark, one degree of freedom. So it's the size of that back reaction is never large compared to the total equilibrium energy density of the plasma.
That allows you to put just a black hole, giving you temperature and rise, and if you say you calculated the disturbance with the temperature, you kept a fixed temperature that was never disturbed.
Yeah, this was imagining that you had an infinite equilibrium plasma sitting there into which you're now injecting one projectile.
And of course, you could ask that.
Think of this locally, you inject this one thing. Don't you think if you get locally a temperature that is
That's what that picture of energy density was. So that those spikes in energy density, you are free to interpret as perturbations in temperature.
He focused on the perturbation at the boundary, but you could just as well look at the perturbation at the horizon, and that's going to change your geometric at the horizon.
Yeah, exactly. You've changed the geometry. Mm-hmm. So you're looking at, in essence, at a temperature spatially dependent temperature, space-time dependent temperature. You could think of it that way. But of course, you could, in principle, study other states too, besides the equilibrium thermal background.
It's small, and then
you make something where you get nonlinear hydrodynamics?
Not in this setting. And the reason is because the gravitational calculation is valid in the large N limit. So you can compute order by order NC corrections in principle, okay? But
so it's really about the principle of the whole approach that you can never get to nonlinear
hydrodynamics.
Well, in principle you could.
Starting with equilibrium and adding a few fundamental quarks.
Exactly.
Now, will you do something dramatic to the bulk degrees of freedom? That could give you nonlinear hydro, but that's a level of complexity.
But the perturbation on top of any of this, whenever you add a fundamental quark to a plasma of adjoint fields and take the large N limit, the perturbation will always be linear at leading order in NC. So you might have some, expanding background that's described by nonlinear hydrodynamics, but the perturbation on top of that will be described by a linearization of the hydrodynamic equations of motion, which is some time-dependent background.
So you just added a few quarks, and you can think of it as a small perturbation. What do I have to look at? How many quarks can I add before this picture breaks down? We have to worry.
Formally, everything here is being done in the limit of an arbitrarily large number of colors. So take any number of quarks you want, as long as you keep it fixed and finite. It's a small perturbation.
What was the physics of this, your field? So you can imagine a hard process producing a quark antiquark pair. That's what gives the initial energy.
Mm-hmm.
And then they just, because they are in matter, they lose energy and they slow down.
Uh-huh.
What was your gamma? Did you say your gamma was
100? Yeah, for this particular event, we chose a large factor of gamma.
But how large?
About 100.
In physics, of course, it's millions and so on.
In terms of energy, I don't actually have that number for you off the top of my head, but the gamma factor was fairly large, about 100.
Okay.
air masses that you would, well, this was zero masses.
Zero bare mass, zero, but you still, in principle, have a thermal mass.
And the zero temperature, you normalize the mass?
Zero temperature, the mass is still zero. It's protected. It's just at finite temperature. You can compute these masses at finite, in a weak coupling, and I don't remember what they are, but they all scale with the tip coupling times the temperature.
You can just take this UH to infinity in your calculation, just go to zero.
Yeah, you could do that. Mm-hmm. And when you do that, you definitely get some qualitative differences in the way that things look. Your string endpoints asymptotically approach geodesics, and basically what happens is you have some creation event, time evolve, and I'll just draw a few things here. Initially, you have somewhat of a curved trajectory, but at late times, your endpoints become uncorrelated. And this is assuming that you've given the string enough momentum to overcome the tension that's holding the endpoints together, which in the field theory language is saying you've given the quarks enough energy to overcome the Coulomb potential. And so what do you get in the boundary theory? You're going to get a baryon density that translates along at constant velocity, but it'll also spread out as time evolves.
You put string breaking here. More pairs in between.
I presumably, yeah. Make the calculation more difficult, of course, but yeah, you can do that.
You can actually just have a part of the dynamics that you're capturing.
No, if you want to approach QCDs, that's of course what happens. You're string breaking. It's almost confined.
This is n equals 4 super Yang mills. There is no confined.
Oh, sure, sure, but you still have fundamental.
But you could, in principle, study a different gravitational theory that corresponds to a confining gauge theory.
Then it's certainly a suppressed
theory. So you basically have to be doing 1/n corrections. It's harder.